Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today I am a little bit fluttery and very excited and honored to speak to one of the most more important voices for me to have moved into this truth that there are other stories out there than the one of progress and the one of Western industrialized civilization, if you will. So welcome, very, very welcome to the podcast, Helena Norberg Hodge.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
I don't know if listeners know you. I do. So, but I'm still going to stick to my format, which is there's just one rule that I start with one question that I always come back to. And that is the very light and easy question. Who are you, Helena Norberg Hodge?
Well, I'm a very globalized person who really doesn't feel any sort of nationality anymore. I grew up in Sweden, but I lived in America, in Germany, in England, France, and then, of course, for many, many years in Ladakh or Little Tibet. And so I become a sort of globalized person who often feels that I'm looking at the world through lenses that are very different from most people. I think I ended up getting a view of the world which was different from most people who were caught up in a particular narrative that had been fed to them, as I see it now, by a press that didn't really help to explain that the narrative of progress is really not an honest narrative. It's one that's been fed to us by the people who gained from sort of herding the human race in a certain direction, away from the land, into big cities and so on. So anyway, so I'm someone who's very globalized and sort of in a way an outsider in every society. But I also feel at home with those people who have either not left the more community-based, land-based structures, and particularly with those who are coming back to that. So I feel like I have a whole global tribe of like-minded people around the world.
Which is, thank you, and which is interesting given that a lot of the work that you're doing now is especially around the localization and that particular movement. And I know you've related it so many times before, but nonetheless, this discovery and this experience that you did in Ladakh, that it seems like put you on your path, or maybe that's just an interpretation from what I've heard. What happened there?
I actually, for a long time, I thought, it was always just Ladakh, but then I realized I was starting to work on a memoir, and then when I was thinking back earlier, I realized that I had been questioning the way that society was moving. I had, from having lived in America and Sweden, I had sort of contrasted those two worldviews and cultures and started thinking about these issues. But it was Ladakh that sort of laid out a sort of a map of an existence where people are more happy, where people are healthier, where there's a way of life that is truly adapted to the complexities and diversity of nature. And that was for sure then compelled me to become very activist in trying to get this message out that we were being lured and seduced to believe that the consumer path, the urban consumer path, is what we needed to become happier. But above all, that was the path that was going to get us the love and the affirmation and the visibility that we all wanted to have. So Ladakh was definitely a very, very major turning point for me, because I arrived in this part of Tibet that had not been influenced by missionaries. I realized too that that was really important. There had been missionaries there, but they had only been able to convert a few orphans. So there was a tiny community of missionaries, but the dominant culture was Buddhist and was closely connected with central Tibet. But they were still an independent kingdom. And then in the 1840s, it had been invaded by India. So it had belonged politically to India since the 1840s. But it was truly like Shangri-La, this part of Tibet high up on the Tibetan plateau. People were living at about 12,000 feet, and they were surrounded for about 8 months by the snowy mountains, so they were sort of cut off from the world. And then later on, when there might have been interest from tourism or there might have been more change, it was sealed off for political reasons, because the Indians were worried about the Chinese coming in, and on the other side is Pakistan, so all the borders were under dispute, and there was army guarding the borders and no visitors allowed. And then suddenly it was thrown open in the mid-70s to outsiders. And I came in and I was with a film team that had wanted me to try to pick up a bit of the language to help communicate with the people. There was a German film team wanting to make an anthropological documentary about these remote people. And from almost day one, I fell madly in love with the people. I had never experienced people who just sort of emanated such a sense of completeness and inner peace and joy. So that's transformed my life.
Yeah, thank you. The I don't know where to go from here. It's so open. But I do kind of maybe still want to pause on this story of progress, because I still meet with the communities that I interact with this acceptance of it, that things were bad before and they are better now. And sometimes when we don't, or if we have a rejection of what's going on right now, then it seems to me like there are certain givens that we don't dare question, that like technology is helping us, or that, I don't know, maybe even the space where I've been mostly, which is entrepreneurship, but this whole idea of business and the limited liability company and those things, how they are creating our moment to a large degree. So I'm wondering, how would you lead us into that, like increasing the resolution or like invite us into your perspective on those things?
Well, I think the way that commercial structures have affected our lives, particularly since you've been alive, is dramatic. And it's, you know, most people are not aware of the extent to which the language of stakeholders and commercial attitudes, you know, being proud and being ambitious and so on, these values have been imposed on us. And they've been imposed on people who are struggling to make a living, but also struggling to try to find a meaningful and sort of respectful position in society. And I saw in Ladakh essentially the difference between a society where the community fabric is strong, where every child from birth onwards is surrounded by a number of people, not a small nuclear family. That's one of the key elements, is that the fabric of community has been broken down through modernity. And when we examine what modernity is, we need to realize that it is the growth in power, essentially, of global corporations and banks. And this is a very difficult journey for most people to make, because most of what we learned at school, most of what we learned in economics and studying history, doesn't tell that story. We're still seeing the world as though national governments have far more power than they do. And I think recently there have been a lot of people who are beginning to see that that's not quite true, but they're then assuming that it's just a few individuals who want, you know, to have power and wealth, and they are consciously trying to destroy the world. I don't think it works like that, but I had this very deep and long lesson in Ladakh about how the economic concentration of power that really started with enclosures in Europe and with colonialism, slavery, and genocide, that centralization of power was essentially global traders, elites that became global, starting in Europe. But as they expanded across the world, they also worked with the elites in different countries, parts of Africa, India, Asia. And so what was being set up was an economic system that gained more and more power for global traders by driving the people away from self-reliance, driving them away from the land into cities where they became dependent on import and export. And what was being constructed was really a system where the specialized economic activity, like just focusing on growing cotton or mining tin or growing coffee, this monocultural use of the land was at the same time very destructive of the land, but it also destroyed people's ability to provide for themselves without being dependent on large anonymous economic forces. So this power that corporations gained really is what today has taken the form of a sort of almost like an empire of interlinked corporations and banks that have this enormous power over our governments. They are getting governments to sign in black and white, we will not do anything that will threaten your profit-making abilities. If we do, you can take us to court. And this is a really important fact that I wish most people would be interested in learning about, because it actually, it clarifies so much of why we're in such a mess. And the thing is, you have to go back through history and look at the steps whereby this process, which started a very long time ago, how it was exacerbated by the crises that were created by that system, by the destruction of self-reliance and of cultural identity. So in the colonial era, when then, you know, powers from Europe went out and conquered different parts of the world, they created this destruction of diversified economic activity, the destruction of cultural and community and cultural self-respect. And as they herded people into cities, urbanization has been a fundamental part of this problem from the beginning. So as people were herded into cities and the number of people farming the land, the number of people producing things was smaller and smaller number, people were then suddenly pitted against each other for scarce jobs. Until this economic system started, this global economic system started, there was really never unemployment. And that means also there was really never the sort of poverty that was created through this modern system. And I don't know how much you want to talk about that economics of it and how much you want to talk about other aspects of it.
That's a sufficient, but what timeline are we talking about? Like when do you perceive that the global economic system started?
Yeah, well, I'm basically saying the global economic system started with enclosures and slavery. So roughly in the 1600s.
Yeah, yeah. Because what came up, I mean, this word monocultures, I think is interesting in a way because of also this, I don't know where I picked up on that idea, but somebody was speaking very sort of eloquently about this idea that we live also in a cultural monoculture in a way that the sort of growth and domination of this Western ideals, industrialist sort of ideals, are really pushing out other ways of seeing the world and comparing that to, even though these are very small cultures today, maybe like some of the indigenous cultures or different more land-based cultures. I mean, it's hard to argue that different national cultures are really, I mean, there are nuances, but they come from a very similar movement. So, and there's also putting that in conversation with, I think, Gabor Mate's idea of the myth of normal, like this idea that there is such a thing as normal, and how that, what that does to us. Yeah,
well, I mean, very much, you know, from my perspective, for sure, steadily, diverse cultures, diverse languages have been destroyed by this process. But again, starting back at the time when European traders started conquering other cultures and accelerating steadily in this whole period for now about 500 years. And what we've been told is that in London, in Dickensian London, there was filth, there was poverty, there was a horrible gap between rich and poor. And it was thanks to modernity, thanks to progress, that things got better in London. But when we actually look under the surface and see what happened in London to, yes, create slightly better or a lot better circumstances for a while for the people living in London. But what was happening in the rest of the world to bring that about was essentially exploitation, was a system that then, well, first of all, as the wealth was concentrated, that meant raping other cultures and it meant colonialism. Later on, the system, we thought, liberated the colonies. We were told these countries are now free, but what we're now realizing is that the economic enslavement through debt and this continual concentration of wealth in the hands of fewer and fewer corporations was continuing. We don't often talk about it in terms of the corporations, but it's very, very important that we see that that's the structure that has become, as a global corporation with the power to tell governments what to do. This is a very dangerous situation. It makes a joke of democracy. It means that we're basically allowing the decisions about the future of the world, about the health of the planet, about the climate, about COVID, all of that, we're allowing global corporations to fund the research, to fund the products, to promote them, and with no legal constraints whatsoever. The deregulation means that they're completely free. Free trade has meant that they have complete freedom. And that doesn't mean that the people inside those corporations are bad people. It doesn't mean that sometimes corporations have done really good things in different countries. Sometimes they've come up with good products. But what it means is, if we really honestly want to look at any hope of democracy, we really have to think differently. And after the Second World War, the people sat down around the table at Bretton Woods. And then the thinking was to avoid another depression, to avoid another world war, we need to essentially centralized economic power. We need to make sure that all economic activity is under one umbrella, one global umbrella. So the World Bank, the IMF was set up, and the GATT. And that was this general agreement on tariffs and trade. And that was an agreement that countries were going to agree to let global corporations have the freedom to come into their countries in order to, as I say, integrate the economy globally. This, from the point of view of biological diversity, the diversity of species, the diversity of everything that lives, you know, we really have to understand that every single plant, every single animal, every single human is unique and constantly changing. You know, the cells in our bodies are changing. In every leaf, in every drop of water, we have this miracle of life, all of it magically interconnected, but with a diversity and a process that we still don't really understand. We're beginning to learn more about the communication under the soil and the mycelia. We're marveling at that. But in the meanwhile, our institutions, our academic institutions, led by corporate funding, are linked narrowly to profit. So it's actually not about understanding the living world. It's about how can we create products that will bring in more wealth. So we're in a very dangerous situation, and at the same time, everywhere I look, why I feel still hopeful, and ultimately, I'm convinced that ultimately life is where the power lies. We're talking about a system that was devised actually by a few men. It is a patriarchal system. It was thinking that started out with very explicit misogyny, racism, anti-nature sentiments. We've got to torture nature for her secret. And, you know, the background to this was also the Christian witch burning, where women who had a lot of knowledge about herbs and plants and were essentially representing the indigenous nature-based spirituality, where women, and particularly elder women, were respected in most cultures around the world. Those women in the Christian world were burned at the stake. So I think it's very stark when we step back to look at it. The problem is that we keep getting a new narrative that puts a bandage over what's actually going on and creates a situation where the crises lead to a further concentration of power in what started out as an overtly misogynist, racist, genocidal system. And of course, in many ways, it has become kinder. It's become more gentle in many ways, and yet, you know, when you really look at this economic system and this narrative of progress, most of the wars are about this. They're about creating structures that demand ever more resource use, that demand ever more energy. And all the time, they're replacing the use of human intelligence, human hands, hearts, wisdom, particularly local wisdom, the local knowledge that allowed people to know that these specific plants are very helpful as for medicine or food, and some of them have to be treated before we can eat them. Some of them, some animals can eat, others, for other animals, they're poisonous. That local knowledge was steadily being eradicated. And it was being eradicated with schooling. And this is a very difficult thing to, you know, explain. You know, when we look back at the history, we must also look at the role of schooling in robbing young people of this, of the local knowledge about living ecosystem and living people and their own history, their own relationship to the land. We should remember that really cultural diversity and biological diversity were completely linked. And this is really the dialogue between people in their ecosystem is what gave rise to to the different languages, to the cultural diversity that we had, and really to culture. I would argue that with modernity, you know, again, if you go deeper back, as I said, Christianity played a big role as a step in this direction of centralizing power, and again, in the hands of men as opposed to women. As it centralized power more and more, it was starting to suppress and destroy diversity, even going back hundreds of years. But what's happened is that, I would say all around the world, but particularly in the West, where people have experienced an urban, very dead environment, where people have been moved into high-rise living, far removed from nature, where they have been so cut off from community, growing up in nuclear families that don't work because they're unnatural. They cut off, you know, the flow through intergenerational contact, the flow of the youngest people in the community being connected to the oldest. That intergenerational contact is fundamental to traditional or indigenous societies. That's been cut off, and the isolation, the separation between people and the separation from nature has led to a thirst and an interest in nature, in community, in the indigenous. And that's extremely positive. This is really this where the hope lies. So there's been this actual cultural turning where more and more people long for those connections. One example I like to give is that film Avatar was really sort of spelling out the zeitgeist, which was indigenous good, corporations bad. And that really has become this cultural turning towards life. However, unfortunately, the people in power that have been particularly, you know, herded into these giant corporations, but generally speaking, even as a head of governments, even earlier on, as government and business structures have developed, they have not changed the basic trajectory of removing, you know, imposing a structure which removes more and more people from the land. The steady destruction of small farmers, the steady destruction of smaller towns and villages, pushing people into bigger and bigger urban conglomerates. That's been happening because the economic structures have been wedded to the same fundamental thinking that started 500 years ago. And that was, it's not in your interest to be producing a range of things for your own region. In other words, self-reliance is not in your interest. You should specialize for export. And what has been created is this insane trading system, because in order for global corporations to have so much wealth, they need to destroy the self-reliant, diversified systems. And there's now a situation where, you know, if tomorrow we all ate breakfast from food in our region, which most of us can't, but if we had that situation, no multinational would make money. But instead, we have a situation where every step of the way, the policies that our governments have continued to support in measuring growth, in measuring progress, have led to an even further concentration of power. In education, from schooling to universities and to the media, the narrative has continued to impose a view of progress which is linked to unending urbanization. If this system continues, we will have 100% urbanization. There will not be any farmers left, because right now the madness of the dominant thinking is that robots can do the farming, and that we will be in cities also managed by robots, and we might have a little bit of a circle of rewilding around those cities, But this absolutely can't work because this blind view doesn't recognize that it, for every step of the way, is using up more of the natural worlds, of the natural world, more resources, while suppressing people's creative ability, suppressing their ability to be able to live closer to nature, to have more control over their lives, to have a shorter distance between themselves, their voice, and those that govern them. In other words, for both nature and people, we need decentralization or localization.
But I wanted to make a couple of just observations. I thought, for one, like with regards to what you were speaking to with the company, I thought it was really interesting. There's this paper from the Bank of England that came out about money creation, which is basically saying that the money creation is not in the hands of the central banks, it's in the hands of the commercial banks. So basically, it's in the hands of debt-creating companies, because you are betting on a future venture that they will do, and then the money is created through that. So there's also this single measurement that we are implementing into our society as the sign for progress is out of the hands of the what we call like sort of the trusted legislator, the elected elites, and now in the hands of also those of the most successful wealth gathering elites. So it's really a self-playing piano at this point. I was also curious to look back at the word education, because you came back to it a couple of times, and it means something like cultivating. It's really about shaping and bringing up to bringing someone up out of something into a specific level, into a specific thing. And I didn't know, and I thought that was interesting.
Well, you know, also there we should look at it was brought in by the elite industrialists that had pushed people off the land, so say in England, and essentially it was limiting their knowledge and skills, because more land-based cultures, the average individual had many different skills, including working with animals, with the land, building houses, often making music, etc. But now people were trained to be little cogs in industrial production machines, and they were enslaved in quite a brutal way. The timekeeping now is incredibly important, because you had to fit in with the machine and the needs of the wealth extraction. This destructive impact of education or schooling, you know, was very, very clear in Ladakh, where, you know, I saw how people who had all these skills were suddenly now trained into, first of all, sitting often virtually in a cement box without windows, learning nothing about their own resources, when traditionally they would have been out there learning from their elders, hands-on, constantly starting, you know, very young to learn and practice and teach. Now suddenly learn not a word about their own resources to feed themselves, to clothe themselves, to house themselves. When they then went on to university, they might learn how to grow food, how to build houses, how to be doctors. And now suddenly they were learning how to use the products from a few global corporations. Nothing about their own resources. So it was very stark and very, you know, just so clear how impossibly, you know, inefficient and destructive this system is. And I do want to make a very strong, you know, well, I want to make it very clear that as far as I'm concerned, the main hope for the future is education, in the sense of doing everything we can to open people's eyes, to look at what's going on, to really becoming better informed in a holistic way, and sharing that holistic picture and information, concrete information.
This may be more in the context of mutual learning, because I see it with my daughters as well, the difference in energy when I try to teach them something, when I try to educate them, versus when we are learning together. When they get to, you know, mess around and explore and do these things, and we're actually learning together. Like, and it's really hard for me to let go of the idea that I know more or have them have something to tell them, and just really sink into this sort of intergenerational transfer, as you will, on a very small scale.
Yes, although I am a bit worried about that. I'm a bit worried that, yes, there now is a tendency for us to feel that we shouldn't be teaching our children. But I have to say, what I saw in traditional cultures is that it was absolutely clear to everybody that the older people knew more than the younger people. There was no doubt about that. And that also meant that the three-year-old had respect for the five-year-old, who could maybe run a bit faster and maybe do this or that faster and learned from them. It was also, but it was learning through doing. It was learning in a process way, and certainly not with being beaten into submission and forced to do things, in a sort of enslaved situation. But I think we have to be very careful in the West now that we often can overdo this idea that the three-year-old really does know. I think it's making children neurotic. I don't think they should be asked, do you want to be inside or outside? Do you want to wear pink or blue? Or I really think the intergenerational cultures, as I say, wasn't even under discussion. That it was just so obvious to everyone that the elders knew more. What's turned it upside down is the technology, of course, where now very often older people have no idea how to even turn on the television set and so on.
Indeed. There's more to be said. I'm gonna let's talk about the localization movement, because I am very what's going on there? This idea that we relocalize, recontextualize ourselves, if that's a word. And what is the antidote to all of this calamity that we are speaking
of? Yeah, no, the antidote is, I think, as I see it, as a pioneer of the localization movement, it's really important that we have a better understanding of the dominant system, its history, and particularly its very, very seductive way of operating today. So what's happened is that the conquering forces that came in with force and conquered people, and often, you know, with genocide and enslavement, now it's through seduction. And it's very frightening to see how the television, how the screen operates to constantly romanticize and glorify an urban consumer lifestyle. And that's making, it's not half of humanity now, but it's certainly probably about 3 billion or something people, who are still more land-based, more community-based, more intergenerational contact, less industrialized people, feel inferior and backward. And it affects the young very dramatically. And so there's this constant seduction going on. And I've seen from Spain to Bhutan to Japan, many parts of the world, that rural peoples assume that those of us who sit in a comfortable chair in front of a screen, just, you know, tapping a few buttons, that we have everything that they do, that we don't need to work, we don't need to get dirty, we don't need to use our bodies. And so this assumption, coupled by constant propaganda, is a huge tide that makes it very difficult for rural communities to interest their young people in staying on the land or staying as part of those communities. So from my point of view, what we have to understand that system, the dominant system, is able to operate the way it is because we've handed over the power to create money, as you were saying earlier. Part and parcel of the concentration of power has been handing over production of every kind, including the production of money, to unaccountable, unelected global entities So if we can think of it as a financial casino, you know, where speculation and debt dominate, but literally where banks decide how much money is going to circulate, who is going to go to, now with the help of algorithms. So this is very, very dangerous. Now, what that system is doing all the time is dumping people in favor of employing energy and technology to carry out, whether it's the production in farming, whether it's mining, whether it's building houses, whatever it is, wherever possible, use up more natural resources, including energy, to replace people. And so that means in most communities now, we are too expensive for ourselves. So we can't afford to be gardening, because if we were to do that and maybe sell a few tomatoes or something, it just doesn't add up, because we have a fake economy. And that fake economy not only delivers in the marketplace something that has used lots of energy and resources at a lower price than something that could have been done very efficiently, very minimal effect in the environment, but also something that's been transported for thousands of miles as part of this crazy system will cost less than a local product. So the global product is entering local markets everywhere and destroying the local businesses, the local production ability. So once we understand that, and once we understand that this is connected to a situation where the middle class has been steadily getting poorer, the poor have been poor before, they are now even poorer, and the middle class are getting poorer and poorer. In fact, the winners in this system are fewer and fewer and fewer. As you and I speak, there are fewer winners because it's moving rapidly. But the wake-up that is so urgently needed is that we understand that the poverty of people, and that means also poverty of time, you know, rushing faster and faster and faster, is completely linked to the rape and pillage of Mother Nature, of Gaia, that the use of energy and resources is escalating as poverty increases. And as fewer and fewer people get richer and richer. Once we see this in a systemic way, I believe we'll be much, much stronger in having many more people actively localize and support the localization movement. But what's happening as it stands now is that, first of all, around the world, there are billions of people that are still more land-based, that still have more communities, still have more skills for creating what could be flourishing communities if they could be liberated from the yoke of this economic system, and particularly also liberated from the psychological blackmail that's going on, the psychological pollution targeting their children to say, if you want to be someone, if you want to be loved, you've got to have these consumer products and you've got to be living that consumer lifestyle. If they can be liberated from that heavy pressure, they have in their hands the ability to rapidly move in a different direction, which could mean really an eradication of poverty. And it's probably a longer story to explain what it would mean if we had more handmade, everything from pottery to houses built by the people who are going to live in them using local materials as much as possible. It is remarkable what could be done and how the shift to create a richer culture with more beautiful artifacts would be linked to healing Gaia, to cleaning the water, to literally allowing the forest to flourish, allowing agriculture that can not only coexist beautifully with wilderness, but be more productive than any monoculture. Any industrial monoculture cannot compete with genuine productivity when competing with really diversified systems, and ideally with animals as well as trees and bushes and vegetables. those diversified systems can deliver remarkable yields in a very short time, but they require more labor. So what's happening is that in the Western world, people who start seeing or even, let's say, feeling this thirst for more community, for more connection to nature, they are all over the world beginning to reconnect to nature and to community. Often they're doing so just intuitively without very clearly analyzing or understanding what's happening in the dominant system. And sadly, sometimes, you know, they're being made to feel like they're not successful, or they're often people who will be sort of black sheep in their family because they should have been important stockbrokers or important engineers. But their inner environment is strong enough for them to listen to their hearts, to their bodies, to their common sense. So they're turning in this direction. And fundamentally, the turning towards nature, towards community, is localist. That means localizing, because you're actually connecting with living ecosystem and living people to start building the structures that we need for thriving economies and thriving cultures. For us, it's very important that that movement be strengthened by more international information exchange, more international collaboration, and particularly between, if you like, global north and global south, or so-called more developed versus so-called less developed countries, but also even between city and country. In most countries, this deeper dialogue where people come together to talk about the truth about how they're feeling, the truth about why there is such an, even that there is an epidemic of depression. Most societies now are not being allowed to really look honestly at the fact that teen suicide, depression is growing in every single country. I know of no exception. But we're being constantly fed with the narrative that we're doing better because the economy is growing. We're actually so well off. You should feel very guilty if you're feeling depressed. But why do you have everything? Why are you depressed? The fact that you have almost no time, because people are running to just keep a roof over their head, put food on the table, this fact about their lives is not getting through a corporate-dominated media and corporate-dominated academia. So what's happening is that the sort of truth, if you like, of what's happening is coming out in, you know, dribs and drabs through alternative voices, alternative smaller institutes. But it's growing. It's growing. And I do believe ultimately, I have no doubt that ultimately this very artificial man-made system, this patriarchal system that is anti-life, will not survive. Ultimately, my concern and why I work very, very hard to try to tell this from my point of view, and obviously I don't have all the bases covered, but I think the bigger picture I'm trying to present can be very, very helpful to give more clarity. I think that's the task, is how can we get that out faster so that when there is a crunch, or you know, if things get worse, which they're likely to do, we're in a better position, that we will have strengthened what we could think of as sort of lifeboats that are the community-based structures.
Yeah, that's one of those things that I've been reflecting on. Is, I mean, because in one way, what I'm hearing you describe is this current system kind of allure or like attracts us with these stories of speed and convenience and the possibility to escape. Like there's this other thing which seems to be that you're supposed to desire. There's a lack that I have here, and so I need to fill that lack with something. I like Eric Fromm's idea of the sort of modal confusion between being and having, and how we've been told that we can solve what we are with what we have. And then at the same time, what you're saying is this increasing, because that's, I mean, it's kind of built into the system that we are being told that we're now in a rush. We really need to solve this fast. And so, of course, you cannot go back and do all those local things because that takes time. And I've heard you speak of that also at some point before, like with regards to the slowing down, like the pace that it is. And now, especially with AI and with all of those aspects, it becomes even faster. And so there is this lure again that, oh, I don't even have to go and educate myself. I don't even have to go and it like, regardless of what we, you know, the way we've spoken about education here, but there's still an opening there. There's a place where we can learn, but now we have a curated thing in between us, which is again, governed by an algorithm that we cannot see. And so I'm very, and at the same time, you know, this house is in some way burning and it's some, in some way we could say that there seems to be, it seems to hurry up with whatever we're doing. So how does those two worldviews square then? Like speed in the sense of this, that's sort of part of the currency of the system and speed in the sense of there is actually something where we do need to move towards and accept and maybe open to not too long.
Yeah, and it's basically similar to what I've often said is we've got to hurry up to be able to slow down. In other words, you've got to hurry up with a message to encourage more people to construct a system that will give us the freedom. It is, in a way, about a human liberation front from the yoke of an economic system that has been an invisible hand almost from the beginning. Because, you know, in the modern world, just the role of the banking and the way the banking changed, the way corporations got more and more power steadily, left government, right government, green politicians, all going along with the main trajectory, not questioning that. And environmentalists not questioning the fact that growth means that pollution, polluted water, is profitable in that system. You know, it's crazy. And then the discussion of capitalism versus communism, not holistic enough, not clear enough, because, you know, so many people would think, oh, okay, well, you know, you can't have capitalism. That means there can be no gap between rich and poor. You can't have any interest. You can't have, you know, some people working harder and maybe having a bigger house. And the assumption has been that, oh, it has to be this top-down, heavy system, socialism, communism. Whereas, you know, what I'm speaking from the experience of different cultures, is a path towards decentralization or localization, which had been promoted to a great extent by people like Gandhi and earlier, Kropotkin and so on, that were called anarchist, because they didn't want, you know, top-heavy centralized government. But, of course, the language of anarchy is so negative, I wouldn't want to use that. And there's a perfectly feasible way forward, which would be with this wake up, so that citizens simply articulate the truth of what's going on and demand of anyone who's wanting. We do need representation now, and we can't. It's very hard for us as individuals to slow down. You know, we're talking about the speed inside a system where we have to work harder and harder just to pay for the food and the roof over our head. And it's also even hard for communities when they come together to do this as long as this system exerts so much pressure. But I just would urge people to, you know, whoever is listening, to think about what they might be able to do as part of a local group. Try to connect with some like-minded people, not too far from where you are. Ideally, maybe show a film. It could be one of our films. And see if there's enough interest in thinking about this, to come together in a particularly what we feel is important, relatively small groups that can meet in each other's homes, that can do so hopefully even once a week, maybe it'd be less than that, but with the goal of realizing there is a way forward where we ourselves as individuals can benefit. We can do things that will alleviate some of these time pressures, that will make us happier, at the same time as what we're offering in Local Futures is materials that will also show you a way to support a more systemic, community-based way to create structures that are needed now and that will be needed in the future. There's an absoluteness to it. It's an absoluteness, again, to do with, you know, clean water and realizing, you know, particularly about the food system, that the global food system is the biggest contributor to destruction, both social and environmental destruction. So looking at that and starting to create more localized or regional food system is one of the most important things we can do for ourselves and for the planet. But then we go on from that and look at even local financing. There's a lot happening that's very encouraging. But simultaneously, what we're talking about is that when we look at the inner life, if you like, the spiritual, psychological well-being, and we realize how disastrous it is that the dominant narrative is making the average Westerner feel guilty about being depressed, being made to feel that they are destroying the world. They have everything and they don't care about these poor people on the other side of the world. They're not willing to use their cars less, and that's why we have climate change. All of that blame, which is false, can be lifted once we understand the systemic nature of it. That doesn't turn the blame into, oh, it's all Bill Gates or it's all, you know, Klaus Schwab. It's not like that, but there's no longer that personal guilt and that ridiculous narrow view, but rather an understanding, oh, it's a system. And I've actually been supporting this system in many ways, but now I'm beginning to see how I can change what I have to say and what I can share with others. Change that narrative. So changing the dominant narrative is then another very important part of what we want to encourage people to do. It's what I call big picture activism as a very important part of an ongoing process, even to get very effective local food economies, local eco-communities, local financing, small business alliances, even to get them going, the big picture activism is an important part of it. To get more people on side, to try to educate the local government, the mayor of a city. And in the localization movement, we're seeing that it's precisely those local figures in politics, the mayors and the local councils that are responding first. Because they are forced to see more of the impact of policy. They're more on the ground, and therefore they respond and can respond better, although they're often locked into a system of over-regulation and wrong regulation at the local level. So there's a lot of regulation brought in that is ridiculous because big business lobbies governments to do so. But ultimately, you know, the funny thing is, as we were saying, is that we need to rapidly try to get this message out and organize. But really, our goal is to slow down our lives, to live at a pace where we can breathe, where we can feel the air, where we can be more in touch with our bodies, where we have more time for our children, for the elderly. That's how we were meant to live. And I urge people in a way to cultivate that way of being as part of what they do, but then also be willing to put on their left brain hat and be in front of the computer, link up with people across the world as well, in order to support an international discourse and information exchange to strengthen this movement worldwide. So it's paradoxical. Just like I've said for a long time, we need to promote small scale on a large scale. So it's not quite enough to just have that small little local. Ideally,
it's the idea of replication, right? I mean, rather than scaling, it's more like replication, which
that's right, replication. Yeah, exactly. And that's something I just wish more people would understand, because there's a tendency for a lot of these good local things to start, and people love them because they're authentic, often healthy products, and then they grow and sell off to a multinational. So we have to be aware of scale, as the whole localization thinking is very much about small is beautiful. Small is beautiful, slow is beautiful.
And in a way, it comes back to this also what we've been talking about now a couple of times with the education. Like, rather than education, I think this is probably more appropriate where we would say sort of learning together. But learning together also means that you are constantly contextually adapting, because the conditions here in Iceland are going to afford very differently. We're going to have very different challenges. Like, for instance, with regards to power and so forth. I mean, given the infrastructure that is there, we don't have a huge limit for that. With hot water, for instance, which is a scarcity, clean water, which is a scarcity in a lot of places, it's not a scarcity here. But then on the other hand, we have weather and specific dirt, you know, earth and soil to deal with, and a climate which is, you know, where we have very short windows for growing or cultivating something and so forth. So, and in a way, what I'm hearing you speak to, which I think is very interesting, is like this. It's like re-enlivening the dependency, like to become dependent on living things again rather than on the system, if you will. And
that means also on others. You know, the social side is very important. And why I've ended up, you know, I helped to found the Global Eco-Village Network. And there are some eco-villages which are very interesting and, you know, become quite big. But I think in many ways it can maybe be ideal now to live near a small town or a part of a small town that can then reconnect with the land around it. And by the way, I did discover in Ladakh that having a very short growing season has many advantages. And I think if done properly, to me, one of the most exciting things is to realize that, to my knowledge, there's not ever been a culture that tried to really optimize the relationship with scarce natural resources. Because in the past, it wasn't necessary. You know, for indigenous people, there wasn't a sense of. But now, some of the farmers I've seen and some of the permaculture projects, and particularly when permaculture has been married to farming, there's some very, very, all over the world, exciting demonstrations of how quickly you can turn barren land into really productive and incredibly inspiring ecosystems that then also attract birds and bees and, you know, really help to heal the whole ecosystem. I'm a little, you know, we have to watch out for the language of regenerative and rewilding and urban agriculture. Now, all three of those things, regenerative agriculture, rewilding, and urban agriculture, could be fabulous. But they are also a way that big business are managing to steer people away from talking about local, diversified, food systems. And the fact that local diversified food systems, where the distance between the farm and the consumers is not too great, can actually rewild simultaneously. And so the worry is that now regenerative is being used by Nestle and Pepsi Cola and so on. And so when we then have some really loved bits of land involving communities that are working hard to restore ecosystems using the same term, they're giving an alibi to and supporting this. So we need to be more holistic in our language. And regenerative is a wonderful word, but let's talk more about the need for diversity, shorter distances, and let's be wise enough to look at process not create some absolute, okay, local. What is local? It's a completely relative term. Mm-hmm. How are we going to put a boundary? But once you understand the global system, then it becomes clear that we must move in the direction of localizing. And exactly what that means in Saudi Arabia today or in Reykjavik or in Ladakh, it's going to be different everywhere. But it starts by, you know, examining what's actually happening and what could happen. And the shortening of distances, of course, you know, means less energy use, less plastic. Yeah. You know, it brings immediate benefits for the ecosystem. However, big business keeps putting out all this propaganda saying that local food systems are not significant. And did you know that in the climate negotiations, there's no mentions of trade? So the global trade, the exchange where countries import beef, the same product being import and export is sent across the world, where food is sent across the world to China to be processed, sent back again. All of that is not calculated at all in the climate negotiation. No mention of trade at all. It's holy. So just that alone should help to wake climate activists up to try to think about what's actually going on.
Another part, I think, of the patriarchal sort of dominating system is the story of the hero. And I think this is kind of one of those parts that we sometimes overlook. I don't hear it talked about much. And as much as sort of individual figures are very important, and as much as I dream of being the drop that sort of made the barrel sort of overflow or whatever you know, one of those things, but like to be significant in some way. But I'm also waking up to the fact of sort of the post-heroic, if you will, sort of that narrative where the hero is the collective and where we do something together and the force of the movement is also inherently collective. And at the same time, like also this language of the second and the third and the fourth order effects of what we do, because a lot of what you are speaking of might not be I might or might not have the chance to sort of live through one of those transitions, but it doesn't mean it's not worth doing. So I think there's something around there as well with the time and the scale and sort of this idea of what makes life worth living, this idea of becoming someone versus this idea of being someone and then doing, I don't know what's right, is contentious language, but nonetheless, there's something there as well. Like it's hard to become a localist, I think, if you also want to save the world.
It's hard for anyone, I guess, now to sort of reduce their ambitions to just a local environment. It feels very small. It can feel very constrained. And now it's quite scary because, you know, young children are wanting to be ballerinas or actresses or environmental activists. And there's that dream of being on that global stage. And really what that means is you're competing, you know, with 8 billion people. Whereas in a decentralized world, yes, the spheres were smaller. But they went out in concentric circles. You weren't imprisoned in just one local and you couldn't go anywhere else. If you could imagine that, you know, so say if I were emperor of the world, you know, what I would be doing would be immediately beginning a process of reducing the scale of the giant cities. I would immediately be changing the subsidies and taxes to encourage the people who were productively healing ecosystems, producing more food, using fewer minerals, fewer toxic chemicals, planting trees, building out of natural building materials. And by moving out of the city, able to do, you know, just one, two-story, maybe five-story building, but all of it using natural materials wherever possible, you know, everything overnight wouldn't have to totally eliminate any cement or fossil fuel use. But beware that a lot of the stuff that's coming in now, supposedly to replace it, is actually more resource intensive. And that's particularly true of all the AI stuff. It's completely, hideously wasteful and toxic. The toxic waste from mobile phones and so on already is just horrific. So this dispersal of the population, the knowledge that actually now we need a lot of people with hands-on skills to heal the ecosystems that were destroyed by big stupid machines using lots of fossil fuels in order to extract wealth to the top and in order to allow for this top-down control. If instead there was this human liberation front and the task was to heal the planet while providing for our needs, it could be so exciting to be part of that. And so exciting to be part of it, even in a relatively small community. But now we have these communication technologies, and in this process, you know, from today until we might reach, you know, I don't know how long it would take, but it might be 100 years until there were, you know, really a much better balance. We could use these technologies to communicate more, to share more. Films can also be an exciting way of doing it. Travel. Again, what we've seen is that environmentalists have been told, you mustn't travel. If you care about climate change, you mustn't travel. While the corporate heads are traveling, not just to negotiate climate treaties, but they're traveling to promote consumerism everywhere. So the travel and the transport increasing massively to support this toxic system that creates unemployment and poverty. So this other system could and needs to now to make use of these technologies. But that's a very different thing from believing that we need even faster 5G or bigger systems. So we should be really clear about putting that message out. And we should be really clear that technology is not neutral, that these technologies came out of the military, and in many cases, they're addictive. And, you know, so that the process of trying to prevent our children from being on the screens, and ultimately, in as I see it, we will become less and less dependent on it. But right now, in terms of information exchange, and also for things probably like monitoring weather and for emergency, they can be very useful. But please, we need to get the message out that we do not need to speed them up. We do not need to have 5G on every corner so that we can have driverless cars. And so many environmentalists are being seduced by that kind of narrative.
And also what I'm hearing too, and I'm very aware that we need to start rounding off as well. But it's... there's something around this progression towards things in one way or another, like that we are more or less stuck with the world that we are living in, and so we do need to be working with it with discernment. That's what I'm kind of hearing you say, and so also working with the tools that we have with discernment, but in some way also trying to keep track of what we at least believe currently is the sort of the best available solution that we can imagine. And then if people keep imagining, then eventually we will get somewhere. We'll see where that is. Are there, because I would love to, so where, with regards to resources and with regards to support for the work that you are doing, where should people go?
Yeah, well, please come to our website, localfutures.org. We're small, very international. I have a little team of about 15 people spread around the world. Many of us have been working together for about 30 years or so. And we have a localization action guide that many people have found very useful. But we also have a website which really... you know, anyone who wants to do a PhD in localization should come to our website. We have an amazing archive because we have been at this for 40 years. And we are planning a very big event in Bristol in the UK at the end of September. You might even want to come, you know, and to interview some of the people. We've invited quite a few of the members of our network from around the world. And we're doing it with the former mayor of Bristol, who also brought in a local currency and so on there. And we expect to have quite a, an eye-opening and very inspiring convergence, or we're calling it Planet Local, exploring the economics of happiness. I think people are hungry for that face-to-face connection, and we really hope that it will strengthen that more global perspective, which is, I believe, absolutely essential to strengthen the localization movement and to help people regain that deeper sense of self-respect and connectedness and meaning that is so badly needed today.
And you said economics of happiness, which is something that I was intending us to go deeper into. But if you would just sort of place a beacon and spark people's curiosity, what is it in a nutshell, or like what's the direction of that in a nutshell?
Yeah, well, again, I mean the direction of it is that I, like Schumacher, the economist Schumacher, who wrote a book called Small is Beautiful, he had his eyes open to completely rethinking economics when he ended up in Burma in the 60s. And he found that there was no unemployment, there was no real poverty. He found the most remarkably happy people. And I, of course, found the same thing about 10 years later in Ladakh, and later on working in Bhutan. So in these three Buddhist cultures, there was, probably because of a very wise philosophy, or if you like, religion, that recognized the interdependence of all of life, of everything that exists, the interdependence and the flux and change. So the teachings of Buddhism were so in tune with, if you like, quantum physics, with the understanding that we have now that everything is connected. And that meant that these cultures were very embedded in nature, very respectful of these relationships. And what that means, above all, is that people were more deeply connected to each other. The structures were human scale. You were part of an economic system where you had access to the people who were sort of in control or had a bit more power. You had a view, you had the feedback loops of actually seeing your impact on other people, on ecosystems, on animals. And these feedback loops are essential to create an economic system that furthers happiness, that furthers health. So really the economics of happiness is a term that we could have used instead, the economics of human and ecological well-being. Because as we know, our well-being and health is completely linked to the well-being and health of ecosystems on which we completely depend. And so we made a film by that name, and it's still a good resource for people who want to start a discussion about these issues, the economics of happiness. We made a more recent film, very low budget. It was based on conversations I had with Gabor Mate and Russell Brand and Ian McGilchrist, who's a very interesting thinker and a great friend, whose understanding now, more recent research of his, has shown very clearly how through modernity, the left brain was overemphasized to the detriment of the right side of the brain. And it completely fits with everything that I'm saying, and why he's also now convinced that we need to localize. The right side of the brain understands and sees the bigger picture, which is the connections, but also the nuances. It responds to the feedbacks from the reality around us, and just recognizing the nuances and the qualities, whereas the left side of the brain makes a nice, neat map and likes to follow that, boom, 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 but stubbornly, blindly refuses to listen to the feedbacks and to to have anything to do with what we might call wisdom.
Wonderful. And I'm just aware of time and I want to respect it. And so thank you so much for taking the time. And thank you so much for coming on. And yeah, there's a whole lot of connections that have become clear through hearing you speak, which I was somewhat aware of, but I wasn't sort of seeing them as clearly. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.